Climate change is already impacting major transportation infrastructure projects in Canada, such as roads, bridges, and ports, as well as the design of our cities, towns, and service networks. These are key investments being made by the public sector and private sector alike. About 20 years ago, professionals in the engineering sector and other transportation fields began organizing to acknowledge and integrate climate change into their thinking. Today's episode of From Here to There focuses on climate risk assessments and the story of how climate adaptation processes started to take root in the Canadian context. I'm climate storyteller Rachel Molina Chan, and I'll be your guide for today's episode as we speak with climate service providers who are helping the transportation sector to build resilience and work creatively to get us from here to there. Please note that the views shared on this episode do not necessarily reflect those of climatedata.ca or its partners. Today's episode features a conversation with Guy Felio. Guy has worked in the field of environmental impact and climate risk assessment for over 35 years as a university professor and educator, researcher, consultant, and policy advisor. His background training is in civil engineering, but he's better known today for being Dr. Infrastructure, a consultant for a wide range of climate risk assessment projects, as well as several transportation asset risk assessment projects. We're also going to hear today from Ryan Smith, a member of the Canadian Centre for Climate Services, to help us understand how people in the transportation sector can use climate data in their work. There are a lot of considerations that go into building infrastructure that could last a lifetime. In an era of climate change, it's even more challenging than usual to wrap our minds around all of the risks that might emerge. When owners and operators of transportation infrastructure need to account for climate change, they often turn to people like Guy to perform a climate risk assessment. I spoke to Guy to understand what climate risk assessments are all about, how they're done, how they impact transportation projects, and how they first took shape in Canada. Well, Guy, thank you so much for joining us today. Tell us a bit about your role and bring us back to some of the key turning points in this world of climate risk assessment.
Well, thank you very much. I'm Guy Felio. I'm a civil engineer, and I've been doing climate risk assessments for 15, 17 years now. I started my career as a professor. Throughout my career, I've been teaching. I continue to teach. And I think that the most valuable thing that I can do is to transfer knowledge to the next generation that is going to have to live through major climate changes. That's my goal. In terms of key turning points, in my perspective, there are two events that took place in 2005 that struck me. That year was the launch of a lot of activities that are related to climate risk assessments in Canada and development of some great tools that we are still using and evolving today. The first one was in August 2005. It was a relatively strong rainstorm that took place in the Toronto area. Very short duration, about half an hour, but a lot of water in that time. And a lot of the areas east around Markham in Toronto got really hit hard and flooded. Finch Avenue, which is a major axis going east to west in Toronto, one of the culverts got completely washed out in probably about half an hour or so. But when you think about that particular culvert and the cost of repairing that culvert back in 2005 was about $4 million. What really started striking the professionals was the fact that insured and uninsured losses due to that one culvert failure were around $500 million. So you can imagine now that you have a culvert which is worth $4 million fails and causes plus 100 times the value of that in losses. And the city of Toronto at the time counted how many of those type of culverts they had, and they had about 150. So that was really something to look at and say, oh, if we have these infrastructure systems that fail, they're going to cause a lot of damages, a lot of costs. The other thing that happened exactly that year was that Natural Resources Canada approached Engineers Canada, which is the umbrella organization for all registered licensed professional engineers across the country, regarding doing an assessment of the vulnerability of infrastructure in the country. And Engineers Canada said, yes, we're enthusiastic. As you know, engineers are always enthusiastic about new challenges, especially in this area, which is really important to the country and engineers, and then realized that we needed a tool. They created a committee, Public Infrastructure Engineering Vulnerability Committee, known as PIVC. looked at how we're going to do this vulnerability assessment. What kind of tools are we going to have? Over a period of two years, created this tool, which is called the PIVC protocol, which is a vulnerability assessment tool.
The PIVC protocol has had a transformative effect on Canadian climate adaptation. The transportation engineers who led the development of this framework spearheaded a process that shapes the roads we drive on, the bridges we cross, and the buildings we dwell in. Climate risk assessments include the use of tools like the PIVC protocol as a template for understanding their climate data needs.
When I got involved with the PIVC back in 2005, I saw this relationship between asset management and climate risk assessments, because asset management looks at the assets over their life cycle. And a lot of these assets that we have are very long-lived. You know, you think about a bridge, which is like 75, 100 years old, water pipes, sewer pipes that are buried, and we expect them to last, you know, 80 years or 100 years. And therefore, we know that during that service life, during that the useful life of these assets, the climate is going to change. And because it's going to change, it's going to create risks. Traditionally, what codes and standards were doing, for example, National Building Code, Highway Code, or others, they were looking at, okay, what has been the climate over the past 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, and said, well, okay, you know, that will be the projection of what happens in the future. But again, back in 2000, 2005, because of the work from world organizations, realized that the future is going to be changing drastically from a climate perspective, and we can no longer say that the past is the future. For me personally, I saw, oh, this is neat. Now I can assess what are the risks to these assets from a climate perspective over their life cycle. So I got really excited. You know, and I'm still excited today about this type of work, because really it allows us to manage the risks in a structured context, which is asset management.
So this is back in 2005, and you've been working on this for the last 15, 20 years. I imagine there were a lot of challenges in the early days in trying to bring this kind of work together. What did you face early on doing climate assessments?
Two main challenges that I recall, and I think that a lot of colleagues at the time that are still practicing will agree with me. You know, where do we get the climate data? We know how to get the engineering data. Now we need climate data, and climate data that is really relevant to the assets or the infrastructure locally that we're studying. And that did not exist at the time. Now we're really fortunate. I mean, I teach a course on climate risk assessments, and I tell the students, well, you're so fortunate because I can open a website, I can go to climatedata.ca, I can go to Climate Atlas, and you have a lot of climate data there. At the time, we did not have those resources. There were really two organizations that were involved in a lot of these PIVC protocol applications. One is the Climate Change Consortium Uranos, based in Montreal, and the other one is PICIC, the Pacific Climate Impacts Consortium, you know, out of the University of Victoria. And their climate scientists were certainly involved in these early days of developing the tools and participating in the application of the tools. That was great help, because now when we're doing a climate risk assessment, we had a technical resource from the climate science perspective. You know, I'm a civil engineer, and civil engineers are not really trained in climate science. I don't even think that when I went to school, they offered courses on climatology. So that was one challenge. And I think that, you know, we have come a long way in those 15, 17 years.
Our second guest today is Ryan Smith from the Canadian Centre for Climate Services. Ryan works with a team of people who provide climate services through the web-based tool climatedata.ca. He's here to help us understand what we mean by climate services, and he'll shed light on how transportation professionals are applying climate data to their everyday decision-making. So Ryan, thank you for joining us today. You have worked with the Canadian Centre for Climate Services since its early days. And so I'm hoping you could tell us a little bit about your background, your role, and just how you came to focus on climate data services.
Thanks for having me here today. I think like a lot of us here at the Canadian Centre for Climate Services, I'm here because I've always been very passionate about environmental issues. I've spent the past decade or so now studying climate science, teaching at the University of Winnipeg and giving presentations, and generally trying to raise awareness of the very serious threat climate change poses to all Canadians. The CCS for me it's an outlet to take that passion and allow me to reach a much wider audience than ever before.
So tell us more about what the Canadian Centre for Climate Services, CCCS, what do they do, and how is this meant to support the transportation sector?
The Canadian Centre for Climate Services was formed in 2017, and it's a division of Environment and Climate Change Canada. Its core mission is to provide climate services to all Canadians. And that, of course, includes the folks within the transportation sector. That term, climate services, is maybe a bit strange if you've never heard it before. In contrast, though, we're all likely aware of what weather services are, right? So weather services involve taking raw data from weather stations and building products and services like forecasts, which are then designed to be easy to use, accessible, right, from your phone, and done using plain language and numbers that are understandable and relatable. So climate services try to do that exact same thing, but with climate data. Instead of forecasts, we provide projections, modeled changes in future climate, and then build services around this data to support practitioners. So we have a team of people who respond to inquiries, we help make maps and other useful data products, and then we work with our user base to find out what kind of data and products they need to better understand the risks of climate change.
So we heard from Guy about how there was only a couple of regional partners around providing climate services back in 2005 when he got started with climate risk assessments. How has that landscape shifted, and how does the CCCS work with regional partners today?
Right. The Canadian Centre for Climate Services is definitely not alone in the world of climate service providers. We work very closely with various organizations across Canada, including the Pacific Climate Impacts Consortium out of BC. We've got Climate West out of the Prairies, Uranos in Quebec, and Climate Atlantic out east. And we collaborate closely on new data and products. And in this way, we ensure our work is authoritative, peer-reviewed, and consistent. We've helped get a bunch of really great climate data up on the web, making it easier than it ever has been before to download and play with. But now we need to figure out how we can go further than this, building products that make it so that building climate resiliency into all transportation projects across the country just becomes second nature. That's the big challenge.
We'll be hearing more from Ryan later on, but for now, let's return to our conversation with Guy and talk about the second challenge that he faced early on, back when climate risk was just emerging as a priority for professionals across the country.
When we're looking at doing one of these climate risk assessments, and again at the beginning, when we were putting together teams for this, quickly we realized that engineers, they may be necessary in the team, but they're not sufficient. And, you know, climate scientists are also necessary, but they're not sufficient. You know, at least one more group that needs to be there present. And those are the people that do the day-to-day operations and maintenance of those assets, because they live it, they see it, they see what's happening to their assets, they remember what has impacted those assets in the past, and they also know what needs to be done in order to increase their strength or resilience. I mean, at that time, we were not talking about resilience. We were saying, hey, you know, you have these risks here. This is the way that you need to do it. And typically, people were thinking, oh, you know, in order to be more resilient, then you need to build bigger and stronger. And we said, no, that's the wrong approach. Because yes, in some cases, you might need to build bigger and stronger. But in other cases, as your operations and maintenance people will tell you, if you do proper maintenance on your assets, keep them in good shape, keep them, you know, at the capacity that they were designed, then you are going to be able to mitigate some of those risks. And then you're in much better shape, you know, to account for what's going to happen in the climate in the future.
The climate risk assessment process has definitely been evolving over these last 15 years, and you've worked with the transportation sector in particular to assess these hazards that climate change poses to things like railways, roads, ports, airports. So walk us through a little bit of what that looks like to apply a climate risk assessment lens to decisions being made by the transportation sector.
There's a lot of things that relate to transportation. It could be private sector clients, it could be provincial, territorial, federal municipalities, the First Nations, various groups that really never work together, start working together from various industries. So it is exciting. You learn a lot. My role in doing these climate risk assessments, I mean, as I said, I'm a civil engineer, and therefore I have very limited knowledge about everything that happens in an airport or a port or so on. But I get to work with all those subject matter experts, and my job really is to get them to provide information, whether it is on the engineering operation side, whether it is on getting the climate scientists or climatologists to contribute. And what I do is really extract what could potentially result in risks from all these data and structure it in a way that showcases, okay, this is what you have been doing that is positive in terms of dealing with those risks. But here are some gaps. This is what you need to work on. Remember that infrastructure has only one purpose, is to provide a service. So you're protecting the infrastructure. Why? Because you're protecting the service. And that's what people want. The people want to see that their services are protected. They're not really concerned that you have 2,000 kilometers of sewer pipes or water pipes. All they want is that when they open the tap, you know, water flows and it's good water. When they're taking their car or they're taking public transit, they can go safely to points, you know, A to B with minimum disruptions. That's the service. We as professionals are responsible to ensuring that the assets that provide the service are there and at the level of safety and quality that they're expecting. You have to know what are the elements that are at risk. So I use that language because, you know, these elements that are at risk could be physical assets, so built environment, buildings and roads and runways and so on. But it could also be people. It could be also the natural environment, because now more and more we integrate natural environment into our asset management process and so on. It could be also the activities that these people do. And therefore, calling them assets for me is not enough. I just call them elements at risk. So that's the first building block. You have to identify those. And you have to have the people that know about those at the table. The second one is really knowing what the hazards are. And in our case is, you know, climate. We want to identify, okay, what are the hazards that could impact those elements at risk.
So today we are talking about climate risk assessments and the need to understand how global heating is going to impact key infrastructure and operations, especially across the transportation sector. Ryan, how can climate data services be integrated within a risk assessment process like Key Leads?
Right. So central to any climate risk assessment is understanding how the climate is likely to change over the next few decades. Most professionals have some sense of how the climate can impact their operations. So usually when some critical threshold has been reached or exceeded, like for example, having too much rainfall in a short period of time, that can lead to flooding, or extremes in temperature that can cause human health issues or damage to infrastructure like buckling, rutting, and that sort of thing. In most cases, when an organization takes it upon themselves to do a climate change risk assessment, they are looking to identify where they are vulnerable and then try to figure out how climate change may lead to an increase in the frequency or severity of these types of impactful events. So it takes climate data, yes. Perhaps most importantly, it takes local knowledge. It takes a deep understanding of a system's vulnerability to weather extremes, a sense of how long-term changes in precipitation and temperature can exacerbate these issues, and foresight into predicting the kind of emerging hazards we need to start preparing for. And I think for most Canadians, frequent and intense heat waves, the fires and the health issues that they spark, are one such emerging hazard that I think many people now realize is a threat we're dealing with every year. So we host webinars, we go to conferences, and we network with all sorts of climate data users, from other governmental departments like Transport Canada, to groups like the Transportation Association of Canada, to industry associations like the Ontario Road Builders Association. So industry is used to using historical data, which means referencing a single number and not having to contend with climate model uncertainties like choosing an appropriate carbon emission scenario.
You mentioned these different scenarios that we may need to plan for, and this is a global effort to mitigate climate change, and so we really don't know what numbers we need to plan for. How do you get your head around that, or how do you help transportation sector professionals work with this uncertainty when they're so used to using a more fixed number from the past?
Absolutely. I think this is one of the core challenges to using climate data, this idea that the future is fundamentally unknown. Climate models are amazing, but they're not crystal balls. They don't magically tell us what the future is going to be like. Climate change is a human-caused issue, and so it involves knowing how human behavior is going to change in the future. We can't know that. That's an unknowable thing. So instead, we produce scenarios. We say, okay, assuming humanity comes together and we all do our part, we reach the Paris Agreement of 1.5 degrees of global warming, then what would that future look like compared to the exact opposite? So that produces a very, very large range in potential future greenhouse gas emissions, and therefore a very large range in future climate conditions that are possible or likely. However, even though there's so much uncertainty, especially as you get near the end of the century, I think once practitioners wrap their head around this idea that it's not about picking and sticking with one scenario for the future, but rather knowing that, well, we should plan for a certain amount of climate change, something that coincides nicely with the intended lifespan of a piece of infrastructure. And once you figure that part out, it's less daunting to have to deal with a range of emission scenarios.
Guy, you're seeing the challenges and outcomes of climate risk assessment up close. Can you give us a few examples of projects that stand out from the last few years? And what can they tell us about climate risk and climate adaptation thinking in the transportation sector?
When you're looking at a community, any community or any industry, transportation sector becomes critical infrastructure for them. So I've been working a lot with First Nations, Ontario and Saskatchewan and Quebec. And you know, transportation, especially for those communities that are remote, that's really, really a critical infrastructure. Working with those communities, you know, certainly Moose Cree First Nation, a Moose factory in Northern Ontario, close to James Bay and the Quebec border. We applied a tool, which is First Nations version of the PIVC. And this was developed with the Ontario First Nations Technical Services Corporation, which really was to take this PIVC tool and you know, apply it to First Nations. This particular community is an island community. So basically, it's near the town of Moosonee, but they're surrounded by river. In the winter, it's a winter road. In the summer, it's a barge or water taxis. And then in between, when the ice is not strong enough or they have ice jams and so on, then the only way to get to the island is by helicopter. So when you're thinking about that, even if you're doing a water treatment plant or sewer system and so on for that community, immediately transportation becomes a critical asset that you need to look at. For example, supply chain. How do you get the chemical for your water treatment plant when you don't have ice road, you don't have barge service, you have to bring them through helicopter? Well, that becomes expensive. And food and even student transportation, if they have to go to the town or mainland. So transportation becomes really critical asset or service that they rely on for everything within the community. And there are many, many of these flying communities across the north. And for them, again, because what we're seeing is that the climate is changing faster in northern communities that we have in southern communities, that they are being impacted much more.
It's interesting because it's not just about how our temperature is changing, but how does that change in temperature impact the function of the service that you're looking at? How does it affect supply chains or education outcomes or health outcomes in a remote community? That perspective on going beyond just thinking about the physical infrastructure and the physical impacts, but the function and the service that is supposed to supply and the disruptions that climate is having on that front as well.
Absolutely. And again, I go back to our earlier conversation, which is if you start focusing on the service, then you start identifying all these aspects that go beyond the hard infrastructure. And then you can start looking at solutions. When we're talking adaptation, it doesn't mean that you need to do everything today. If we're forecasting that the temperatures of 40 degrees are going to happen in the 2080s, you don't need to put super air conditioning systems today into the system. However, if you're building an asset or infrastructure that is going to last that long, please just reserve some space within the building to put bigger air conditioning systems so that when you need them, you don't need to retrofit the building. And actually, that's the principle of Montreal Transit Commission did when they were looking at their expansion of the metro. You're building a new subway station, which is going to be deep underground. You know that eventually you're going to have larger cooling systems, and you don't want to have to dig near the existing subway station, you know, a metro station to put that larger equipment. Let's make a room as we're building it now that can accommodate that new cooling equipment that we'll need in the future. And you know what? If you don't need it, you have extra space. You know, you can use it for whatever you want. It's a no-regret solution.
That sounds like a good way to manage that inherent uncertainty as well. It's not about waiting around until we have this perfect number and this perfect certainty about what we're going to face, but this general knowledge that we will face change and the general understanding that that change is going to happen is already happening and is going to happen within the lifetime of some of the infrastructure that we're building. And so, like you said, to just get ahead of that, and sometimes it's leaving space for a future solution and not necessarily having all the answers on day one. So given your substantial experience working with the transportation community over the past decades, how do you see this evolution of climate data use within the transportation sector? How has the scope changed, or how are more or different people been brought to the table?
From the climate data perspective, what's encouraging, particularly in Canada, we're very fortunate to have these public data available and the evolution of the models and the type of analysis that you can do with the data. It's really fascinating to see how this field has evolved. And even recently, you know, we're talking about the last 4 or 5 years, these tools were not as comprehensive.
This conversation around adapting to climate risks is evolving and gaining momentum year over year. Ryan, what's your vision for climatedata.ca and services like it?
This is a great question. I mean, my vision is that climatedata.ca continues to evolve to become the flexible system it needs to be applied to the myriad of different applications that are out there. I mean, what we've learned is that the way a road construction company uses climate data is extremely different from the way a government department might use it. We need to develop systems that are powerful, flexible, and above all, they have to be easy to understand. We've been doing a really good job, I think, so far of providing guidance and training materials to go along with all of our products, but we need to take that much, much further. We need to improve climate literacy first and foremost if we expect people to be able to understand and use climate data. We have the data. We have the understanding of where the climate is heading. We just now need to figure out a way to apply that information in the real world.
It strikes me that there is some excitement in more and more people seeing this as part of their work. Like, I think that climate services, climate data, climate jobs used to be sort of considered their own thing in their own silo. But we're feeling this shift now, I think, where more and more people are realizing that their lives are impacted by climate change, that their job requires them to be factoring this in, especially when we're thinking as long-term as transportation infrastructure. I agree with you. I think that there's a lot of momentum and a lot of potential here, but it does require that people really see themselves as part of this story and see themselves as having an important role to play.
Absolutely. Hopefully we get to that point where we come together and we have a system where the government can support climate services, providing data, doing core research, but then we have innovative new processes out there that can take these data, take this information, and actually apply it at the end of the day.
What inspires you to continue doing this work in light of all these complexities and uncertainties? What drives you?
For me, I'll always be a bit of a data nerd. I have always loved playing with climate data, developing these various products and services, and experimenting. I think that's what really drives me, is tinkering with the data. So that's probably what drives me most. But, you know, I have now 2 children. I have to contend with the fact that the future is pretty dire sometimes. Certainly when you turn on the news, that's the way it comes across. And so for me, I now have to start thinking about my family's future. And certainly that feeds into my energy when I come to work.
I think that from the practical perspective of doing climate risk assessments, now there's much more people that are involved in doing them, that have learned, that have the experience. And so this is great for the country and for all the infrastructure owners out there, that they have a pool of really qualified people that can do this. Climate risk assessments should be part of the requirements of the environmental impacts assessment. It's the environment. It's looking at the life cycle. It's looking at all the impacts. So that's my vision. So hopefully before I fully retire, that vision will be fulfilled. But I think that we're getting there. I'm very hopeful, and hopeful not only from a professional perspective, but I think that from a societal perspective, this will be great benefit in terms of managing those risks over the next 30, 40, 50, 100 years.
Canadian climate services are evolving to meet the growing demands of integrating climate data and enhancing resilience in the face of ongoing climate impacts on systems, infrastructure, and the environment. Thank you to each of our guests for sharing your stories and helping us understand how climate adaptation happens in practice. If this episode piqued your interest in climate adaptation and the climate variables relevant to your region of Canada, visit climatedata.ca for more. Thank you for joining us on this pilot episode of From Here to There, Climate Adaptation Stories. Just a reminder that the views shared on this episode do not necessarily reflect those of climatedata.ca or its partners. Join us next time and stay curious about climate adaptation.